as journalists get to, you know, explore this system and think through the new stories that may come from it, that they talk about the impact this has had on their ability to do their jobs.
One of the core roles journalists play in a democracy is being a government watchdog, exposing corruption and the influence dark money has on our elections. Today, I talked to someone fighting to give journalists and the general public the tools they need to do just that. I'm Michael O'Connell. This is It's All Journalism. Elizabeth Shimmick is the senior legal counsel for campaign finance at the Campaign Legal Center, which is defending Proposition 211 in three cases at the moment. She's here to tell us about the act and what it means for journalists and those who desire greater transparency in campaign finance. Elizabeth, welcome to the It's All Journalism podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you're here as well. I mentioned being a local reporter, locally focused reporter. You know, campaign finance is one of the things that I love doing. I just recently spent, you know, months, about 6 months working on a big project that was really heavily based on campaign finance. And it's amazing that when you have the access to that information, the types of stories you're able to do, the things you're able to uncover. And so for me personally, it's huge. And I hope a lot of more journalists realize that, you know, if your state's got that ability, then that's something you need to take advantage of.
Local journalism is so important when it comes to accountability in government.
Oh, for sure. It's one of our primary things. But first of all, tell me a little about yourself. What got you interested in campaign finance and how did you end up at the Campaign Legal Center?
So as you mentioned, my role is senior legal counsel for campaign finance. And what that means kind of beyond the title is I work primarily at the state and local level in a couple of different areas, working to build better campaign finance laws and defend good ones. So I work with advocates and policymakers to develop good policy, to implement it at the regulatory level and give feedback through that process. And then I also help to defend laws like Prop 211 that push for better transparency when there are lawsuits challenging them. Before I came to Campaign Legal Center, and I won't go into all of my career history, but I previously worked as legislative and campaign staff. And when I was looking for kind of the next step in my career and in my life, I was looking to join a workplace that was really working to address the issues I saw in our democracy, the issues that affect all of us, regardless of our partisan stance. And I was so excited to be able to land at an organization like CLC, where we're really kind of putting the law to work for democracy.
I'm glad you said for any partisan stance, because one of the things that I've actually been kind of delighted about when I do write stories that are based on campaign finance, mostly it goes across party lines, unless it's something like, oh, we really need this. But people don't like seeing the outsized influence that businesses have and large donors have on their elected officials. So,
absolutely. You know, we've seen studies, study after study, showing that across partisan lines, people care about transparency in their government. It's a big priority.
So, you know, what you just described, is that kind of jibe with what CLC's mission is? Is it a little broader? What does the CLC do?
So CLC is a nonpartisan nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to protecting and strengthening democracy through law at all levels of government. So we work in four main areas: campaign finance, which is my division, ethics, voting rights, and redistricting. And since its founding in 2002, CLC has actually participated in every major campaign finance case before the U.S. Supreme Court and in many, many other federal and state court proceedings. So kind of at its core, our work is devoted to promoting every American's right to participate in an accountable and transparent democratic process.
Excellent. Excellent. Really good work to be doing. So was CLC involved in Proposition 211 in Arizona? Or the adoption of it, I guess.
The short answer is yes. So kind of overall, as I've just said, we're advocates for democracy, and we spend a lot of time thinking about transparency and campaign finance, working on potential solutions around issues that we see. And when Terry Goddard, who is the former attorney general in Arizona, and his group, he's a co-chairman of Stop Dark Money Arizona and Voters Right to Know, he approached CLC as he was working on one of his multiple attempts to make what it was eventually Prop 211, to get it on the ballot in Arizona and then to advocate for its passage. He came to us as legal experts as policy experts, and we help to develop the principles of how Prop 211 works in a way that would provide for real full disclosure of the original sources of this money that's being spent in Arizona in the election ads. And so that would also be easy to defend against court challenges. And then we also worked to look at the language to ensure that the policy actually works in context. It's not just a great idea, it's a functional one. You know, we're well aware of the fact that there are many wealthy special interests who want to influence voters without disclosing who they are, that they'd be likely to challenge the law and fight to prevent people from having the information they need to be fully informed voters. And we were prepared to fight that battle in court, as we are now doing on three different fronts.
So, you know, my own experience is the project I've been working on is the effect that casino businesses are having on campaign donations, campaign finance in the General Assembly in Virginia. And it's a lot of money. And Virginia is one of those states where there's no real limit. It's really kind of a limit of what can they get away with. The last election, I think they broke a record in Virginia for one of the races. But was Proposition 211, I mean, it was enacted in 2022, right? So has there been an election where this has been in place?
2024 is the first election that will really see the impact of Prop 211. So it's been going through varying stages of implementation as the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission, you know, created rules. The Secretary of State created the system for submitting reports, and that went live in January. So it's very exciting. We're looking forward to seeing these reports as they start to roll in.
So what is it that the Voters' Right to Know Act, what does it really do?
So I think going back even farther, as you and many of the listeners, hopefully most of them know, the Citizens United case opened the door to unlimited spending by entities using the corporate form in our elections. It's not just businesses, corporations, which I think we kind of immediately think of, but there are many iterations of the corporate form that can be used as front groups for election spending, like, for example, 501c4 nonprofits. And over the years, post-Citizens United, we've seen lots of attempts to regulate election spending. But the loopholes have really swallowed the law. What the Voters' Right to Know Act does is it turns on the lights on what we would commonly call dark money. That's secret spending by wealthy special interests to influence people's votes. Because people who see campaign ads deserve to see the sources of that money trying to influence them. So what the Voters' Right to Know Act does at a high level is it brings the law back to what the Supreme Court always thought that spending would look like in Citizens United. We think about this corporate spending, but Citizens United was actually also a resounding endorsement of transparency in our elections. In an 8-1 portion of the decision, that's 8 justices agreed that if this money was being spent, the spenders had to reveal where the money was coming from. That's one of the reasons SCOTUS allowed corporations to spend in the first place, is they thought with full disclosure, it would lessen any potential for corruption and people would know who was spending. So when the Voters' Right to Know Act comes in, we see that it's meant to trace back money link by link all the way back to the original source of that money. And I think it's important to know it only applies to the big money in elections. There are high thresholds. The disclosure portion of the Voters' Right to Know Act, I mean, the act generally, only applies once a spender has spent $50,000 on statewide campaign media spending in an election, $25,000 for like legislative races, not statewide races. And it only reports donors who have given more than $5,000 toward that spending. It's focused on the biggest money, and then it traces back through the intermediaries to the original source of that money. Because we know, we've seen wealthy special interests, you know, pass money along through chains of LLCs and 501c4 nonprofits and PACs and super PACs, so that you don't really know where that money came from by the time an ad hits TV.
I wasn't planning to talk a lot about the story that I was working on, but, and all of this is kind of legal in Virginia, but we also have a very good transparency down to $25 donations. You can find out you know, what somebody gave to a candidate. Virginia also benefits from the fact that we have an organization like the Virginia Public Access Project, which publishes the campaign finance reports. They create graphics and they compare donations coming from different industries and things like that. So you can actually, when something's like that in your state, then you're able to sort of build a story around it. But something that I was always careful to do was, you know, I'm reporting this stuff, but all the stuff is legal. These people are not doing anything illegal. This is what they're allowed to do under the current law. And it's kind of important to remind that. But in the case that I had, what happens is, you know, they created a PAC. They were funneling money through the PAC, which is, again, perfectly legal. They had employees and corporations within their company, small LLCs, which contributed to the cause that they were contributing to. Anybody just looking at all of these different, oh, wow, look at all these different people, all these different organizations that are backing this, but it's really one organization. So we have transparency, but unless somebody really looks, you don't get the big picture, I guess.
Yeah, without laws like Prop 211, wealthy special interests really, I think in many ways, are incentivized to create a maze to hide where money and spending is coming from. And Prop 211 in particular, I know we were talking about, you know, disclosure of donors to candidates. Prop 211 focuses on independent spending, so that's spending separate from candidate spending. But it does actually include spending by state parties if state parties accept more, I think it's donations larger than $50,000 from an individual contributor. Because this spending comes from all over the place. And when you don't have limits on where that money can come from, as under Citizens United, it really matters to have that transparency, to have that reveal, because otherwise it is possible for wealthy special interests to hide.
Yeah. Politicians will say, oh, well, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm influenced because I, you know, I accepted a donation from such and such a person. But anyway.
And even beyond donations, I think it's important to think about, you know, politicians know, even if it's not coordinated between an independent spender and a politician's campaign, politicians tend to have a pretty good sense of who's spending money in support of them or in opposition to their opponent. Even if there's no coordination, even if there's no communication between the spender and the politician who eventually benefited from it in an election. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that stays in someone's mind. If you know, well, you know, I didn't talk with them, but so-and-so, you know, had this pretty big ad buy saying that my opponent hates dogs and that influenced my election. I better keep them in mind.
I wonder why the media hasn't asked my opponent why he hates dogs. You know, it's so Citizens United, how has that sort of been dealt with across the country? Are we seeing a lot of laws like Prop 211, or, you know, are there ones that are more stringent, a little more, that provide more transparency? Are there particular states that don't seem to be doing anything?
Yeah, well, Arizona really leads the way on this. This is the gold standard. We've seen other states prior to Arizona try to enact laws with similar goals or similar laws. Alaska and Rhode Island come to mind, but those mechanisms are not as robust as Arizona. When it comes to helping the public to know the original source of the money in their elections, that is, as I said, this is really the gold standard. It's very exciting. And we've seen other states considering this and introducing bills.
Let's talk about the three challenges to Proposition 211. And actually, I guess you recently represented, or I guess defended 211 in federal district court and had a victory. What is the argument against 211?
Well, let's talk about the federal case. That's Americans for Prosperity v. Myers, which is the recent decision we just got. So Americans for Prosperity, in their challenge, were nominally attacking Prop 211. They were challenging the law whose main feature is this traceback disclosure, going all the way back and revealing intermediaries and that original source of spending. But the nature of their arguments at heart were against all disclosure for independent expenditures, whether it's disclosure of the direct funder of an ad, like Americans for America paid for this ad, the intermediaries, like groups that might have passed money along, or the original sources. This is a very bold attack on all disclosure. when the court looked at this, when the court issued its decision about 2 weeks ago now, it looked step by step at AFP's argument, which kind of went against this long chain of cases, including Citizens United in favor of disclosure. It addressed each element of Americans for Prosperity's argument. And more than any court that has looked at this law before, they really understood the law and how it works and rightly concluded that it was completely constitutional.
And it fits under the umbrella of Citizens United?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in fact, and I touched on this a little bit earlier, when the Supreme Court decided Citizens United and allowed all of this spending to come into our election system, it did this with the understanding that there would be disclosure, with the understanding that people would know who was behind this speech and who was speaking to try to influence them. And while that has not borne out in most kind of laws post-Citizens United, Prop 211 follows in that tradition and really returns the law to what SCOTUS thought it would look like when they issued that opinion when it comes to transparency.
What about the two other cases? What is it they're arguing? Is it the same argument, or do they are coming at it from different angles?
The two other cases come at it from a little bit of a different angle. So the first case is Center for Arizona Policy versus Arizona Secretary of State, and that's in Arizona State Court. So the plaintiffs in that case were challenging it not under the U.S. Constitution, under the First Amendment, but under Arizona's Constitution and their free speech provisions. And I'm happy to say that throughout the challenge, both the opinions the court issued in that case, first on what they would call a facial challenge, challenging the legitimacy of the law as a whole, the court found that Prop 211 is very much constitutional under the Arizona Constitution. And then they also allowed the plaintiffs to take a bite at saying, what about as it affects us personally, not generally the law. The law is generally valid, but how does it affect the Center for Arizona Policy and the other plaintiffs? And even with those arguments, the court found that the law was constitutional and dismissed the case. So right now, we've just seen, as of this month, the plaintiffs appeal. So it's been appealed to the Arizona Court of Appeals. We're waiting for, you know, all of that briefing and argument to be scheduled on the ticky-tacky legal procedure. But the thing to know about that case is that the court found Prop 211 is constitutional and valid, and it remains in effect. And the third case, which is also in state court, involves a challenge largely on separation of powers grounds by the speaker and the majority leader in the legislature. But I won't get into the nitty-gritty. That's much more. You don't need to hear all of it.
You don't need to know everything. This is what you need to go. So in the previous one you were talking about, was it the argument that this was, which I guess was part of Citizens United, that the donations are a form of free speech in a way, and that's protected? Were they arguing for privacy? Is that what it was? Is like this organization, you know, just because somebody gave, you know, money, they deserve their privacy?
You know, at its heart, they were making arguments around protections for free speech and around freedom of association. But the goal, as with the Americans for Prosperity case, was to challenge and prevent disclosure of the original sources of money that's being spent to influence elections. And, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are certain contexts in our history where anonymous speech has been important. But the fact is that in, you know, all the Supreme Court cases that address speech in the election context, the Supreme Court has said over and over that anonymous speech is not consistent with an educated electorate and a corruption-free legislature. And that disclosure is, in fact, in legalese, but the least restrictive way to fight corruption. If you want to fight corruption, if you want an educated electorate, people can speak, but they have to disclose who is speaking. And that is, you know, the least restrictive way to deal with speech is just attributing it to its source. So, you know, I'm really, really excited, really pleased by the decisions we've seen in Center for Arizona Policy and Americans for Prosperity, because it's clear that at the state level and at the federal level, the courts understand and are following precedent, supporting the voters' right to know who is speaking to influence them, supporting this law that doesn't restrict speech, it provides the opportunity for more speech, for attributed speech. And through that, again, supports a voter's right to be informed, to be making intelligent decisions at the ballot box with all of the information in front of them, and also fight corruption and the appearance of corruption that can come from big election spending.
Well, and 72% of the voters in Arizona seem to agree with that idea.
Absolutely.
And I think that's democracy, right? That, you know, the voters have spoken in this, and granted, voters have often voted in things that turned out maybe later on that weren't the smartest thing to do. But in this case, certainly, it seems like there's a lot of support for the proposition.
I mean, when you look at Arizona, you know, one of the most purple states, if you want to talk about it that way, one of the states where, you know, elections are very close in the partisan aspect, whether it's at the local level, the state level, at the federal level, 72% of voters across partisan lines thought that it was important to know who was spending to influence their votes. And that kind of bipartisan, that kind of nonpartisan policy support is not something that you see every day in this day and age. I think it really speaks to how much people value transparency in their government and really want to know who is putting these messages in front of them. You know, I live in Wisconsin, another very purple swing state, and my TV ads are already flooded with election-related stuff. You know, my social media is flooded with election-related ads. And people deserve to know more than just Americans for America supported this. They can make better decisions when they know, you know, whether they agree or disagree with the funders who put a message before them.
And even the argument from a lot of people who, you know, they want to get truthful information, they want to get facts. And, you know, part of that is who is paying this money? Who is saying this thing and identifying them? And so, again, that's why it gets so much support in a bipartisan area, because they recognize that, you know, this is going to benefit everybody. It's, you know, they'll be able to, you know, see what their opponent is doing, but at the same time, their opponent is going to be able to see what their candidate is doing as well. And where they're all playing sort of on a level ball field under $5,000 or whatever.
Yeah, well, and without Prop 211.
Yeah.
You know, in a state that doesn't have it, you know, if I'm a wealthy individual with some very clear personal interests, and I want to spend on an election, but I don't want people to know that I'm spending. You know, I might take a controversial opinion, and I don't want my neighbors to say, hey, I disagree with you. You know, there are a lot of easy ways to do that. I could set up an LLC, do a little business, but mostly just fund it myself. And maybe I'll put the majority of that money from the LLC into a 501c4 nonprofit. Maybe I make it myself. Maybe my friend makes it. And then that 501c4 will donate to a PAC, a political action committee. That PAC donates to a super PAC. And eventually that money gets spent, maybe not even in my state. Maybe it crosses state lines a couple of times. And eventually it ends up in Arizona. Even though I live in Wisconsin, I think Arizona should take this other policy. You know, it's a meaningless front group is what the name says. It's, you know, Forest for the Trees running that ad. But folks in Arizona would deserve to know that I, someone who lives in Wisconsin, think that, you know, they don't deserve to have trees. You might assess that message a little bit differently.
You know, this is a journalism podcast, so we look at a lot of things from a journalism perspective. But that being said, freedom of information is for everybody. I mean, it benefits us. It benefits reporters because it allows us to do a lot of different things and report on different types of stories and do our main job. But everybody, this is something that everybody should be concerned about. I mean, what would you say to journalists in a state that does not have any legislation? How could they tell that bigger story?
You know, I think I'll come at it from a little bit of a different angle. When you look at what's happening in Arizona with Prop 211, there are two kind of main things that the law does to bring more information to the public and to journalists as members of the public. First, it requires these big spenders, spenders who spend over $50,000 on statewide campaign media spending or $25,000 on non-statewide races, to file reports that show over, you know, those donors over $5,000, where that money came from, kind of tracing back the links in the chain to that original source. So you get these reports that have lots of information. It also has on-ad disclosures. So not just paid for by Americans for America, but paid for by Americans for America, top sponsors, Elizabeth Shimmick, Michael O'Connell, and Business Corp Incorporated.
You shouldn't trust those people.
So you see kind of not just the immediate sponsor of the ad, but the original funders of the ad who put the most money in toward it. So when you've got these reports that people can go and see on the Secretary of State's website if they really want to dig in, but also that immediate disclosure of the biggest money behind big money ads, that really, as I said before, enhances your ability to understand who's putting messages in front of you. And if I were thinking of it from a journalist perspective, I think the most exciting thing is the avenues that this opens up in helping to educate the public and communicate with the public about who's spending in your state, in your community, to influence opinion. There's a lot of interesting stories that can come, and it's just gotten that much easier to know where that money is really coming from. And I think, you know, I hope as journalists get to, you know, explore this system and think through the new stories that may come from it, that they talk about the impact this has had on their ability to do their jobs, effectively, to really dig in on these important stories.
Yeah, that goes into something I talk about all the time. And I talk about it to people, you know, that I meet at meetings and things that I'm going through, this idea that the journalists are really bad explaining what we do. So it's important for us to explain our process. And part of that is, if you're looking into campaign finance, you show where you got this information so that they understand that not only do they get, see that it's, you know, truthful, that it's fact-based, but they can then begin to understand how that system works and how that system is influencing the electoral process. And I can tell you, on the stories that I have written, I've gotten such positive feedback from all over the place because people recognize that that's local, you know, statewide journalism. That's the type of things that we need to be doing to fulfill our long-term mission, I guess. So
yeah, it comes back to not only that First Amendment right to be educated and informed voters, but the idea that overwhelmingly across partisan lines, people want to know what is happening around them, what is happening in their elections, what is happening in their government, and where those messages are coming from. And local journalism is a critical tool in finding that knowledge and disseminating it.
Elizabeth, I could sit here and talk to you all day about campaign finance. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Thank you for the work that you're doing in Arizona and with the Campaign Legal Center. I hope these other two cases turn out the way you hope they do, and that the voters of Arizona will soon begin to benefit from the law that they voted for.
Yeah, I'm excited. Like I said, the reporting system has gone online as of January. So, you know, as election spending ramps up, I'm sure we'll see new reports rolling through.
Well, that'll be good. Thanks again for being on the podcast.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the people who report the news. You can find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. While you're visiting our website, sign up for the It's All Journalism newsletter. To make sure you don't miss an episode of It's All Journalism, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Google Play, Amazon, and pretty much anywhere good podcasts are found. If you'd like to help us grow our podcast, like and share our episodes on social media. Look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It takes a lot of people to create an episode of It's All Journalism. Nicola Grisco is our audio producer. Amber Healy writes our web content. Amia Brust is our booking manager. Steph Thomas manages our social media. Nick Dupre composed our theme music. Carolyn Bilewski designed our logo. And I'm your host, Michael O'Connell. Thanks for listening.